1 Corinthians 1:10, the first talk in a series titled Reading the Book, Lessons in Understanding the Bible, was presented by Ron Julian on April 3, 2001, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Understanding how we understand the Bible. Now that sounds very simple. The title for the subjects, the theme or the title that has been picked is Reading the Book. And Ron is going to give an introduction tonight. Ron Julian is our speaker, teacher tonight. And Ron has some strong expertise in this area in understanding the Bible. That's his central calling, so we're excited to have him. I would have to say, I asked for a moment to say something personal to you about this topic. In my mind, there is no more critical issue, nothing more critical, nothing more important than understanding how we get the message of the Bible from the Bible. Now, for many, that may seem an academic thing. You know, you have to go off to theological school or seminary. I mean, that's for heavy-duty experts. And there's a certain sense in which understanding the Bible does take a big commitment. And if you're going to study it seriously, it is a difficult study. And I think Ron is going to try to unpack that a little bit. But the fact of the matter is, understanding how to get the authors, what the authors meant by what they said in the text of the Bible, there could be no higher priority than that. Because until we do that, until we have some confidence in what the biblical author is saying in the text, we don't have the Bible. You can be carrying the Bible around with you. You can even be, you know, meditating over the pages or something, but you do not have the Bible, you do not have the Bible's message until you understand what the author meant by what he said. And that's a big part of what this series, Spring Term, is going to focus on. So without further ado, I want to turn this over to Ron.
This is, as Wes said, this is a very interesting topic to me. I got started doing what I'm doing basically because when I became a Christian at the age of 18, I had been a very committed atheist up to that time, and my initial assumption was that now that I'm a Christian, all these Christians that I'd always been looking down on for all this time, they must all basically agree on everything, and I'll just find out what it is we believe now, and we'll go from there. And I started to discover that there were a lot of important issues about what the faith meant and how you get saved and who's saved and what do you do with the problem of sin in your life and all kinds of things that were really hitting me in a big way that people did not agree about. And I found people going to the Bible and making the exact opposite points from the same passages. I was tempted for a little while to become cynical about the Bible. Well, you've heard people say, you know, you can use the Bible to prove anything. And I was sort of starting to get that attitude. Fortunately, God had pity on me and gave me an opportunity to study a little more and think a little more about what it was the Bible was saying and how we understand the Bible, and I came to have a very different attitude. I think, in fact, that you cannot use the Bible to say anything or prove anything, that the Bible really has a particular message And the problem is that we end up going in so many different directions because we're really not paying attention to the way the Bible itself is talking. Now, I don't want to claim that we can just solve all problems. You take this class and then the entire world will agree about everything from now on. I'm not saying that. But what we want to do in this class is give you kind of a seat-of-the-pants feel for the difference between a good, solid understanding of what a biblical text is saying and one that is not good. The fact is that it makes a difference. I'm not afraid to say right up front that I am convinced that at least at this age in the church's history, unfortunately, in much of the church, we have lost the ability to read the Bible. We can go to the Bible and grab verses and pull them out and use them to defend our favorite doctrines, but the idea that we can actually go and read the text and understand what it is the biblical authors were saying, that's something that we're not getting taught. I don't know exactly why it is we're not getting taught it, but we're not. So, like I say, it's a topic that I have thought a lot about. We here at the Study Center have thought a lot about it. This year, we are publishing a book on the topic that Nav Press is publishing. We're very happy about that. And as a part of that, we thought it would be nice to go over some of that material with you all. But what we're going to do here is different. What we have in mind is different than what we did in the book. The book is very systematic, sort of taking first this aspect of the problem and then the next aspect of the problem and sort of breaking it down and approaching it quite a bit of detail. That's not what we're doing here. Like I said, what we want to do here is just sort of give you a seat-of-the-pants sort of feel for what good biblical interpretation looks like. And we're going to do that by looking at a series of passages. We're just going to pick each week a passage to look at and to talk a little bit about how we approach it and how we can move toward an understanding of what the text is saying. We're trying to pick passages that illustrate certain points. So there are a number of principles involved that we're going to try to bring out, as I say, not systematically, but just by looking at various examples. Our starting assumption is that the Bible is the revelation from God that it claims that it is. The men who claim to be prophets from God were in fact prophets from God. The man Jesus claimed to be the Messiah, the Christ, and that's who he is. The men who claimed to be apostles sent by Christ are in fact the apostles that they claim to be. So we're coming to the Bible with an eagerness to understand what it is those prophets and apostles were saying. They had a message. They had an understanding from God, given to them by God, and we want to be able to come away understanding what it is they were saying. Now, there is a, in order to illustrate the kind of point that I want to get across tonight with the passage we're looking at, I made up a little story, and you all will have to get used to me and my little stories. I apologize in advance, but it makes my point. Okay, so in my little story, there is a father who tells his son, I want you to go out and play basketball with your cousins. So the son goes out, and he decides he wants to do what his dad has told him to do, so he's going to go out and do that. When he gets outside, however, he has this problem. His cousins tell him, we've decided we're not going to play basketball. We're going to go inside and play video games instead. So the question is, what should he do? He wants to be obedient to what it is his father told him to do, but the circumstances have changed a little bit. What would his father want him to do in this situation? Well, if you stop and think about how it works in real life, what we would do in that sort of situation is the son would think back about what it is the father had said in the context in which he said it and in the circumstances in which he was speaking. He would think about, what did he mean? What did he have in mind when he said this? He didn't just come home one day and there was a rule pasted on the refrigerator, rule number 17A, go play basketball with your cousins. I mean, his dad said it in a particular situation. So what was his dad getting at? Well, let me give you some different scenarios. In scenario A, the son happens to be a particularly lazy sort of couch potato kind of kid, and he wanted to stay indoors and play video games. His dad said to him, I want you to play basketball with your cousins. In that scenario, the reason he told him that he wanted him to go play basketball is because he wanted him to get up off the couch and go out and get some exercise. Now, in this situation, luckily enough, there are some other guys from the neighborhood next to his who come by after this scenario happens, and they say, well, we're about to play baseball. And so he decides, I know what my dad wants me to do. He wants me to get some exercise, and so I'll go play baseball with the guys from the other neighborhood. Was it important that he play basketball in particular? No. It's just that his cousins happened to be playing basketball, and he wanted him to get outside and do something. So, what should he do? He should go play baseball with the guys from the other neighborhood. But now let's imagine a different scenario. The kids from the other neighborhood that I was telling you about, they're gang members. And the father was concerned that the son was going to join this gang. He told him, I want you to play basketball with your cousins, because he wanted his son to play with his cousins and not go and play with the gang members. And so in this situation, forget about exercise. His dad wants him to play with his cousins and not with the gang members. And so what he ought to do is go play video games with his cousins, because that's what his dad wanted him to do. But let's imagine yet another scenario. The son is trying to get a basketball scholarship. The father said, I want you to play basketball with your cousins, because he wanted him to practice basketball. That's what he needed to do. So what should he do in this situation? He should not go play video games with his cousins. He should not go play baseball with the guys from the other neighborhood. He should go find somebody to play basketball with, because that's the point. Basketball is the point. Well, my point is that the father's words are not just a rule that it's kind of floating around in space. You don't just grab it and say, okay, I just do what this rule says. It's coming from a context. It is being spoken into a particular situation, and there is something in mind. He can't really be obedient to it unless he understands the whole picture. Well, I would say that if we're going to be good readers of the Bible, then we need to seek to understand the situation out of which the authors are speaking and the situations into which they are speaking. To be a poor reader of the Bible is to pull out verses and say, look, I have a verse. It says, pluck out your right eye. Okay, I'm going to do it. This verse says, before I make my offering at the temple, I should go make up with anybody that I have something against. Never mind the fact that I don't have a temple anymore. I'm going to do what this thing says. I noticed that none of the women here are wearing anything on your head. There's a guy wearing something on his head. No women wearing anything on your head. I imagine that's because all of you are rebellious, evil people who have disregarded what it is that Paul said in 1 Corinthians 11. All of you have marked yourselves as the rebels you are by your behavior. I'm shocked. I'm outraged. Or is it just possibly, perhaps, the reality that maybe Paul was speaking into a particular situation and had something in mind when he was talking about the head coverings on women? So that's the general sort of principle that I want to illustrate tonight, is that we can't just jump in and start pulling verses out and doing something with them. We have to have some idea where they're coming from. What are they talking about? So that we can have a clearer idea of what the biblical author is implying and is not implying in what he said. The passage I want to talk about tonight is 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 10. Now I exhort you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all agree, and there be no divisions among you, but you may be made complete in the same mind and in the same judgment. Part of the reason I want to talk about this passage is it gives me an opportunity to talk about some of the background that helps us to understand this particular passage. And we are going to stay in 1 Corinthians for a couple of weeks in this class. Some of you at Gutenberg students have been here already in the class you just got done with last quarter, but that's all right. And this is going to do two things for us. Tonight, it gives us an opportunity to illustrate one point that I want to make, and it also sets us up for the next couple of weeks. So that will be good. Now, I came across someone talking about this passage just the other day on the internet, on a discussion board that I was looking at. They were pointing to this passage and saying, "You know, look at all of the denominations that we have in Christianity. Obviously, we are not following what Paul said here. We're supposed to be complete in the same mind and in the same judgment. There should be no divisions among us." And the point is made then, what is it that makes divisions? What is it that leads people to divide in the church? Well, we know what it is. It's theology. We start talking about theology, and well, the Bible says this, and somebody says, no, it says this, and before you know it, there are divisions, and we're not being of the same mind. If we're going to obey what it is Paul said here, then, what we need to do is stop emphasizing theology. We just need to all agree to love each other and believe in Jesus. And if we do that, then we will be obeying what Paul said here, and there will be no divisions among us. I have heard this kind of talk often in my career as a Christian. So the question I want to talk about tonight is that what Paul is getting at in this verse? Is that what we ought to conclude when he says here that there should be no divisions among you? Should we conclude that what we need to do is abandon theology so that we can make sure that there are no divisions among us? Is that what he's getting at? Now, how are we going to do that? Well, what I would like to do tonight is to do some exploring for us to try to put ourselves into the world that Paul was living in, into the situation that the Corinthians were in, and to try to get some sort of an idea about what Paul was talking about. This is a letter that Paul wrote to a church in a Greek town called Corinth. And we can't really understand what it is that Paul is getting at unless we put ourselves in that situation. The problem is, you know how to do that when it comes to your own life, to the letters you read, the newspapers you read. When you pick up a newspaper or you read a letter, you may not have thought about it, but you know an awful lot. You know the language, you know a lot about the culture, you know the slang. When you get a letter from somebody, from a friend, you know that friend, you know something about his life story. I mean, you know a lot. You know it pretty painlessly in the sense that you have just picked it up by hanging around. I mean, you didn't do a doctoral dissertation on your friend's life. You just hung around with them. And by hanging around with them, you get to know them. And so you know all kinds of things that you use when that person is talking or writing a letter to you. The problem is that it's too late for us to go hang around with Paul and the Corinthians to try to figure out what was going on and what it was that they had on their mind and what was the problem and so on. We just can't do it. And so in order to find out what the situation was, we're going to have to do some reading. We're going to have to go back into some texts. I mean, how else are we going to know what was going on back there except by the fact that people wrote down what was going on back then? Paul wrote this letter, for instance. We have two whole letters, big, long letters that he wrote to the church in Corinth. Surely in there, there's going to be some evidence as to what was going on in this church. We have the book of Acts that tells us some things about the founding of these churches and so on. We have history books that tell us things about Greek history, Greek culture, the city of Corinth, and so on. We have these things to help us put ourselves in the place where we know something about what's going on there. Now, I recognize right off, this is where the rub is. I mean, I know that I am about to lose somebody right here. Somebody has checked out right now, because what I'm saying, in essence, is we're going to have to do some history. We're going to have to do some historical research to find out what it is that was happening in this situation into which Paul was talking. And it's very easy. I mean, I'm not looking down on this. I understand the problem. Who cares? I mean, if we can come to this class and I can tell you, this is what God said about your problem. You have this problem, and God said if you do A, B, and C, the problem will be solved. Then you all will be very interested in what I have to say, because, hey, great, I want my problem solved, so tell me. Give me the A, the B, and the C, and let's go. But we're going to talk about people who have been dead for a long time. I mean, their problems are all over. Why are we dragging it all up again? What does it matter that the Corinthians weren't getting along with each other? And what does it matter who Apollos is? I mean, Apollos shows up in less than a dozen passages in the Bible. He's not a big deal. He didn't write anything that we know of, unless somebody wants to argue he wrote the book of Hebrews or something like that. No big deal. Why should we care? And I'm not being glib about this. I'm serious. Inside us, there's this thing that comes up to that and says, why should I care? It's not my problem. It's not what my life is about. Well, all I can say is, think about it. If I told you that today God was at my house and he told me a whole bunch of stuff that's really going to revolutionize your life, you would start saying, well, okay, so what did he say? And I said, well, he was talking to Fred about this. And you said, well, who's Fred? I mean, you would start trying to find out, you know, what was the situation? Who was there? What were they talking about? Well, it's the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. The only difference is that this happened 2,000 years ago. And so it's a little harder to get at. But I recognize the problem, and all I can tell you is, I believe with all my heart that you are not going to be able to understand very well what it is that Paul is saying in 1 Corinthians. Paul, the apostle to the Gentiles, messenger from God, we're not going to be able to know what he's saying unless we get some kind of idea of who were these Corinthians and what was their problem and what was he talking about. So what I'm about to do, you know, you all have to forgive me in advance, but what I'm about to do is going to sound an awful lot like history and all of that kind of thing, but it's the history of the most important events that have happened in the history of the world, and that's my defense. Okay, so let's get started then. The immediate context of the passage that we're talking about, and by that I basically mean the next few verses that come after it, Paul says, after saying that he doesn't want any divisions, he says, I have been informed concerning you, my brethren, by Chloe's people, that there are quarrels among you. Now I mean this, that each one of you is saying, I am of Paul, and I of Apollos, and I of Cephas, and I of Christ. Has Christ been divided? Paul was not crucified for you, was he? Or were you baptized in the name of Paul? So, here's a little bit of information for us. The situation in Corinth is that people seem to have divided up. Some are saying, I am of Paul, presumably like, I am a disciple of Paul. Others are saying, I am a disciple of Apollos. Some are saying, I am a disciple of Cephas. Cephas is another name for Peter. This is basically Peter that we're talking about here. And some are saying, I am a disciple of Christ. And Paul's saying, has Christ been divided? mean, are you telling me that all these Christians are supposed to be dividing up and into different groups like this with different leaders somehow? Is that the way it's supposed to be? So this starts to give us a little bit of a picture of what's going on. But I'd like to tell you right now that this doesn't really give us enough of a picture yet of what the situation is and what Paul's concerned about. Because I can imagine a lot of different scenarios where people could be split up in the way that he's describing. It could be a division that's basically, you know, when, you know, like around here, I'm going to be talking, Jack's going to be talking, David's going to be talking, various people are going to be talking. So I find that there's a different set of people here when Jack's talking than there are here when I'm talking or here when David's talking. They're saying, well, no, Ron, I can never understand anything he says, but Jack, now, he's hot, so I've got to hear that. Is that what we're talking about here? Are we talking about civil war? Are we to the point that people are having to take armed bodyguards with them because they're being mowed down by the followers on the other side? I mean, what exactly is the problem? What is it that Paul wants in this situation? What is he worried about? It might sound like he's worried merely about the fact that they're having this disagreement and they're kind of have cliques going. The first thing we might think about is there are these cliques happening. And we've all had experience with that. You know, there's the in-group over here and the in-group over here. And that must be what Paul's talking about, right? He's concerned about cliques, and we don't want to have those kinds of things happening. Well, maybe so. But we don't know enough yet to know whether that's the problem. All we know is that people are lining up somehow with various teachers. We know enough to know that it's not necessarily because the teachers want them to do that. Paul himself, at least, is saying that there are those who would say, I am of Paul, but he doesn't want that. He's renouncing it. So he clearly has not been trying to gain a following like that, and yet the situation has happened. So where can we go to figure out more about what's going on here? Well, one of the places that we can go is we can look in the first several chapters of this book and read through and try to follow, see if we can find some sort of a thread, some sort of information that'll help us see a little bit what's happening. I am, for the purposes of our class, taking it upon myself to pick things that I want to highlight. You might very legitimately come along and say, well, Ron, I think we ought to highlight different things, and you ought to be prepared to make that argument. But for tonight's purposes, I want to highlight certain things because I think they're going to ultimately show us some important things about what Paul's doing. The first thing that I want to point out, if we were to read through the first several chapters of 1 Corinthians, is that this issue about the divisions, although Paul is going to go on, he's going to start talking about how the message of the cross is wisdom from God. He's going to say we have the mind of Christ. He's going to talk about rewards and how there are some sort of rewards, the famous passage about wood, hay, and stubble and that kind of stuff. It might seem like he's going off first in this direction and then over here and then over here, really scattered in a number of directions. But what's interesting to me as we read through these first like four chapters of 1 Corinthians is this topic about the divisions keeps coming up. He keeps coming back to it. In chapter 3, he says, "For when one says, I am of Paul, and another, I am of Apollos, are you not mere men? What then is Apollos, and what is Paul? Servants through whom you believed, even as the Lord gave opportunity to each one. I planted, Apollos watered, but God was causing the growth." This is three chapters. There's a whole first chapter and a whole second chapter, and yet here we are at the third chapter, and here we are back on that topic again, about how people have chosen up sides. At the end of chapter 3, he says, "So then let no one boast in men, for all things belong to you, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or things present or things to come." Now, it's not immediately clear what he means by that. What is he saying? Well, we don't know at the moment what he means by that. But as we're gathering our information, it is striking that once again we're back at this list, Paul, Apollos, Cephas. We're back on this issue somehow that they have chosen up one over the other. This is what he has on his mind. It's starting to look like whatever it is he's doing in these first chapters in 1 Corinthians have a lot to do with this problem that he's talking about. Okay. Finally, in chapter 4, he says, "Now these things, brethren, I have figuratively applied to myself and Apollos for your sakes, that in us you might learn not to exceed what is written, in order that no one of you might become arrogant in behalf of one against the other." Here again, Paul and Apollos. He says, what I've been saying earlier, I'm saying it's figurative language that I'm using and applying to this situation with myself and Apollos, so that nobody becomes arrogant on behalf of one against the other. Clearly, that's the problem. That's what's happening here. People are becoming arrogant about one against the other. There's another striking thing that you notice. He mentions sometimes that there are people lining up with Cephas, Peter. One time he mentions Christ. But in every one of these situations, he mentions Apollos. Sometimes he doesn't talk about Cephas. In several places, he just says, "Look, I'm trying to get you to think right about me and Apollos." So, it sort of sounds like Apollos looms very large in this picture, that somehow he is a part of the problem. I'm not saying that he caused the problem, but that Apollos seems to be a central part of this problem. So for us to understand what the problem is and what Paul is trying to tell them, it would be great if we could figure out a little bit about who Apollos is and what the problem might be. So, at this point, having seen that Apollos seems to be very central to the problem that's happening here, one of the things that we can do is we can take one of the tools that's available to us as students of the Bible. We live in an age where we have a huge, huge quantity of tools available to us that we can use to find out things. One of the tools that we can use is called a concordance. And maybe some of you have seen them before. A concordance is basically a list of all of the words that occur in a particular translation of the English Bible, and you can go and look up a word that you're interested in and find all of the verses where that word occurs. Well, if I would like to know more about Apollos from the Bible, a simple thing that I can do is I can go to a concordance and look up Apollos, and it will tell me every verse in the Bible where Apollos is mentioned. So, as might not surprise you, I did that. And what we find when we go and look for that information, see what we can learn about Apollos, the main passage that it takes us to is Acts 18. Besides the passage we're in, besides the 1 Corinthians passage, the main passage it takes us to is Acts 18. So I want to take us there for a minute. Acts 18 starts with the founding of the Corinthian church by Paul. Paul goes to Corinth. He meets up with Priscilla and Aquila. He stays in their house. He lives there in Corinth for a year and a half, it says, and he founds the church there. He preaches the gospel. They start meeting in the house of the synagogue leader next door to the synagogue, because he gets kicked out of the synagogue, basically. He spends a year and a half there. And after that year and a half, it says, He took leave of the brethren and put out to sea for Syria, and with him were Priscilla and Aquila, and they came to Ephesus, and he left them there. So, at the beginning of Acts 18, I read about, it's handy actually, this passage that tells me about Apollos. Before it tells me about Apollos, it tells me about the Corinthian church. Paul goes there, he lives there for a year and a half, he founds this church, and then he leaves with Priscilla and Aquila. They go to Ephesus, and he leaves them in Ephesus and takes off. I put a map on the second page just so that you can have a little idea of how this might work. If you can see in the upper left of the map, what we have is the body of land on the left is Greece. The body of land on the right is Asia Minor. Ephesus is over in Asia Minor on the right. Corinth is in Greece over on the left. And you will notice that Greece there, instead of being called Greece, the term that's used there across it is Achaia, which is the name that it was, that region was known by at the time. Okay, so Paul was in Corinth for a year and a half. Then he left with Priscilla and Aquila. They went to Ephesus. He left them in Ephesus and he took off. Went back to Jerusalem and then up to Antioch where he had started. So there's the situation. That's where we are so far. Now, we start to read about Apollos. Apollos comes on the scene. Now, a certain Jew named Apollos, an Alexandrian by birth, an eloquent man, came to Ephesus, and he was mighty in the Scriptures. This man had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and being fervent in spirit, he was speaking and teaching accurately the things concerning Jesus, being acquainted only with the baptism of John. And he began to speak out boldly in the synagogue. So, here's Apollos. He is a Jew, but he is from Alexandria. Alexandria in Egypt. Very cosmopolitan area. A Jew living in Alexandria like Apollos would be a very well-educated, cosmopolitan person. Not only have a Jewish education, but also be exposed to a lot of the learning of Greek culture and so on. But when Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they took him aside and explained to him the way of God more accurately. He was very fervent, very eloquent. He knew the Old Testament. He was raised with a knowledge of the Old Testament. But he wasn't exactly clear on exactly how it worked with Jesus. He knew what John the Baptist had said about Jesus, and that was enough to convince him that Jesus was the Messiah, but he didn't know a lot more than that. So Priscilla and Aquila take him aside and say, hey, it's great, you know, you're in the synagogue teaching about Jesus. We just need to kind of point out that you don't quite have the story right here. Let me explain to you what's been going on. And so they explain to him, he gets excited about that. And when he wanted to go across to Achaia, the brethren encouraged him and wrote to the disciples to welcome him. Achaia, remember that, what I just said, that's Greece. In other words, he's in Ephesus, he wants to go over to Greece, and in particular to Corinth. This somewhat new believer, eloquent, powerful speaker, very enthusiastic, he's going over to Corinth. Now, Paul has left Corinth and Apollos is going over. So Apollos and Paul have not actually had any interaction at this point. Priscilla and Aquila have sort of brought him along and sent him over to Corinth and said, hey, this is great. You ought to meet this guy. He's really good. When he arrived, he helped greatly those who had believed through grace, for he powerfully refuted the Jews in public, demonstrating by the Scriptures that Jesus was the Christ. And it came about that while Apollos was at Corinth, Paul, having passed through the upper country, came to Ephesus and found some disciples and so on. I just left that part in to show. It's clearly saying Apollos has gone over to Corinth and Paul is somewhere else. Okay? So, what we see in Acts is Apollos is an eloquent man, He can powerfully debate the Jews, proving that Jesus is the Christ. He is an enthusiastic believer, somewhat new to the details about the gospel and exactly what's going on, but very helpful and encouraging guy to have on your side. That's who Apollos is. Now, Paul is writing this letter to Corinth after the events that we have just read about here. Apollos was in Corinth for a while, and evidently, while he was there, there's a group of people that decided that they liked Apollos quite a lot. And they've sort of said, Apollos is our guy. That's the situation into which Paul is writing. There's one last, if as we look through the concordance, there's one other passage that's significant. At the end of the letter to 1 Corinthians, Paul says, concerning Apollos, our brother, I encouraged him greatly to come to you with the brethren, and it was not at all his desire to come now, but he will come when he has opportunity. So, when Paul is writing this letter to the Corinthians, Apollos has left Corinth, and he is now with Paul. And as it happens, where they are is back in Ephesus. They're in Ephesus, where Paul had left Priscilla and Aquila. He'd come back around to Ephesus. Apollos has come over. Now Apollos is with Paul. And presumably, Paul has heard about the divisions and so on, not only from Chloe's people, as he describes it, but also from Apollos himself. It's hard to know how much to read into the fact that Paul is encouraging Apollos to go, and Apollos is basically saying, I don't want to go yet. I just have the suspicion that, given the situation into which Paul is writing, that Apollos is a little bit concerned about the fact of what has happened, the divisions that have come up, and is embarrassed to go back, or doesn't want to add fuel to the fire, wants to stay away from there for a while, or something like that. Paul himself had no problem with him going back. So, evidently, Paul and Apollos at this point are on fairly good terms. So it's not like Apollos is the bad guy. He didn't set out to cause this problem. But the problem has happened, nonetheless. Okay? Are you with me so far? Is it clear enough what's happened? Apollos? Okay, good. I want to point a couple of other things your way. As we look around in 1 Corinthians to try to get a little more of a picture of what it is that Paul has on his mind, there are some other things in what Paul says that I want to point out to you. Because there are these little hints and themes that come out in the letter that are sort of intriguing and I think ultimately really show us something about what Paul has in mind. He says, let me just read these to you and kind of point out this theme that keeps coming up. Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not in cleverness of speech, that the cross of Christ should not be made void. Again, in chapter 2, he says, and when I came to you, brethren, I did not come with superiority of speech or of wisdom. There again is this issue of his speech and his wisdom. He sounds a little bit defensive, I think. You know, I didn't come to you. I didn't mean to come to you with superior speech and wisdom. And my message and my preaching were not in persuasive words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power. Yet we do speak wisdom among those who are mature. Later in chapter 3, he says, and I, brethren, could not speak to you as to spiritual men, but as to men of flesh, as to babes in Christ. Coming back to this issue of how it is he spoke to them when he was there. And I think there's kind of a hint that we're going to see is very worth pursuing, that he's feeling somewhat defensive about how it is that he spoke, that he needs to defend the way he spoke to them, because perhaps somebody doesn't like the way he was speaking. there's so much of a hint of that that notice the last passage I referred to there, chapter 4, verse 3. He says, "To me it is a very small thing that I should be examined by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even examine myself. For I am conscious of nothing against myself, yet I am not by this acquitted, but the one who examines me is the Lord. Therefore, do not go on passing judgment before the time." Now here's a fairly clear indication here. Do not go on passing judgment before the time. Passing judgment on whom? Passing judgment on Paul seems to be the situation. He says, "To me it is a very small thing that I should be examined by you." Clearly implying that he is being examined by them and found wanting. That some of the people in Corinth have a complaint to make against Paul. And the hint here would seem to indicate, if we look at the way he keeps coming back to the question of how he spoke, we might get the idea that at least part of the problem that they have with him is some sort of a complaint about how he spoke. That's sort of interesting, because what we read about Apollos was that Apollos was an eloquent man, and he was a powerful debater of the Jews. Paul, on the other hand, keeps sort of saying, "Look, I didn't intend to come to you with eloquence or superiority of speech or wisdom. I just preached to you that Jesus is the Christ and that he was raised from the dead. That's what I intended to do, and that's what I did." Do we have any other sort of evidence from the letters that Paul wrote to the Corinthians that there was some friction between Paul and some of the Corinthians, that they were not accepting him in some way, that they didn't like the way he was speaking, that maybe they resisted his teaching, something like that? Well, actually, when we read through the Corinthian letters, we do start to find some very interesting indications of what the Corinthians thought about Paul and about his teaching. There are a couple of things I want to point you to. I'm actually going to skip the first couple of in my last page there. It says going farther into the Corinthian letters. I'm going to skip the first couple of them for a minute, and I want to go to the passage from 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians 10:10. Here's Paul writing to the Corinthians, still the same group, and he's talking about them and what some of the people among them are saying. "For they say of Paul, his letters are weighty and strong, but his personal presence is unimpressive and his speech contemptible. Let such a person consider this, that what we are in word by letters when absent, such persons we are also in deed when present." Now there's something pretty darn explicit. Paul is saying, some of you among the Corinthians are basically saying about me that my speech is contemptible. That I am, it's like Paul is a hick. You're coming to these sophisticated, cosmopolitan, Greek Corinthians, and you just sound like a rube, Paul. I mean, you just come and you're always talking about Jesus and the cross, and it's boring. It's like, why should we listen to you? There's nothing impressive about your speech. Okay, yeah, you can write a good letter, but when you get there in person, I mean, everybody's bored. Don't you get it, Paul? Can't you see how everybody's drifting off while you're talking? We're not interested in listening to you. How far does it go? Is it just kind of a stylistic thing? You know, we wish that you'd let Apollos talk a little more. You know, maybe you take 25% and he can take 75% because he's more interesting. Well, actually, look at some of the other things Paul says. He says, "I consider myself not in the least inferior to the most eminent apostles. But even if I am unskilled in speech, yet I am not so in knowledge. In fact, in every way we have made this evident to you in all things." And then he goes on to say, in the next chapter, "Actually, I should have been commended by you, for in no respect was I inferior to the most eminent apostles, even though I am a nobody. The signs of a true apostle were performed among you with all perseverance by signs and wonders and miracles. Paul is saying the signs of a true apostle were conducted among you to establish his claim that he, in fact, is an apostle. The resistance to Paul among the Corinthians is so strong, we're not just talking about a stylistic thing. Gee, we kind of think that Apollos is more interesting. We're more inclined to show up when he's talking. This is a group of people who, in saying Apollos is our guy, are saying at the same time, Paul is not. The divisions that he's talking about are not just cliques. They are actual factions among the Corinthians where there are people who have set themselves up and said, we do not listen to Paul. Paul is unimpressive. Paul is not a wise man. Paul's speech is contemptible. Paul is not really an apostle. That's the kind of stuff that he's facing in opposition in Corinth. So, when you put that into the picture, now the scenario looks quite different. There are these factions in Corinth. Some of them have lined up with Apollos. It doesn't seem that Apollos wanted to have it happen that way, but somehow, you know, at least young in experience, convert gets into a situation where, hey, he's out there, he's eloquent, he's mowing them down, people are coming, let's go see Apollos, you know, take on another Jew and debate today, you know, and everybody's there cheering him on, saying, oh, that's a great point, you know, and it's like, you know, it's like going to watch wrestling or something. You've got your guy, and he's just in there mowing him down, and everybody's saying, oh, Apollos is so great. You can imagine how it might happen, that it might kind of go to your head, and you might sort of lose track of the fact that people are starting to use you in a way that you don't really want to be used. Apollos is an eloquent man. Now, when you do a little background research, look a little in the history books, the books that talk about the time, you discover an interesting thing. That at this period of time, there was a resurgence of interest in what is called the group called the Sophists. It comes from the Greek word sophos, which means wisdom. And the Sophists were a group of Greek orators, philosophers and orators, who prided themselves on being keen debaters. The idea in being a sophist is that you were able to decimate any opposition that came your way. Whichever side of an argument you were supposed to take, you could take it and mow down whoever you were dealing with. Sophists, not surprisingly, were hired as lawyers. Sophists were hired as political orators. And the idea is you want to get a sophist on your side because he can get in there and make your case for you. We can't absolutely prove anything, but the fact is that you want to know where one of the centers of this resurgence of interest in sophistry was at this time was in Alexandria, which was Apollos' hometown. So Apollos, eloquent man, evidently educated in Alexandria, probably educated in such a way that Greeks like the Corinthians are attracted to his style. They like that ability to debate and mow down the opposition. There's something really attractive about that. Whereas we can see, at the same time, many of the people in Corinth have looked at Paul and they are not interested in what he's saying. They're Christians, they would call themselves Christians, but as you go through the letters, some of the other quotes I had there, the fact is, these are Christians who reject much of what Paul has to say, including even the message about the resurrection. They don't buy that, because if you look at the history a little bit, you can find that the idea of resurrection was considered to be incredibly naive and superstitious by the sophisticated Greek philosophers. You have this situation where Apollos is eloquent, and there are these people that really like him, and yet they look at Paul, and basically they don't agree with him, they don't like the way he talks, much of what he says they don't accept. They're going a very different way than what Paul is teaching. And the two letters that we find to the Corinthians are Paul's attempt to jump into this situation and establish some priorities here. What is it that's really important? Culminating in, I might point out the very last quote I have on that page. Paul's concern about the Corinthians is so severe that he ends up in that section saying, "Test yourselves to see if you are in the faith. Examine yourselves. Or do you not recognize this about yourselves, that Jesus Christ is in you, unless indeed you fail the test? But I trust that you will realize that we ourselves do not fail the test." If you go and read the last couple of chapters of 2 Corinthians, you'll find some of the most biting and sarcastic language that Paul uses for anyone, anywhere. He is deeply disturbed about what's happening among the Corinthians. This is not just a little, oh, this guy happens to like this guy's teaching a little better. This is an out-and-out rebellion against Paul as an apostle of Jesus. He's fighting for his place as the apostle that founded the church. They're basically saying, okay, great, well, you know, Paul came and he told us about this Jesus guy, and that's great, but now we've moved past him. We sophisticated Corinthians can see that we really have a lot to offer here that Paul doesn't really get. Paul doesn't really understand how this stuff works. And it has to do with all sorts of issues. They have a different view of sexuality. They have a different view of spirituality. They have a different view of the resurrection. They have a different view of marriage. I mean, all along the line, Paul is fighting off this resistance to where it is he's going. Okay. Now, having looked then somewhat at, I mean, and it's kind of a whirlwind tour, I know, of what's happening in the background to this letter, we can come back to our verse and recognize that there's a little bit more going on here. When Paul talks about that he doesn't want divisions among them, can we really imagine now when we look at the situation that his primary concern is that they not disagree with each other? Let's forget about theology and just all agree to love Jesus and love each other. Both of these letters are filled with his admonitions with, here's the problem with your theology. Can we imagine that he would be happy if they wrote back to him and said, Paul, we have taken your advice. We are of all the same mind. We all think you're a rube. We have all decided that you're not an apostle and we don't want to really have anything to do with you. You won't have to come here anymore. This clears up your schedule. Would Paul step back and say, oh, I am so happy that they have stopped arguing about theology and they're just agreeing together? Of course not. I mean, this would be like a life and death tragic mistake on their part. To look at the message of the apostle to the Gentiles and say, that's foolish. That's superstitious. That's not the sophisticated Greek wisdom that we are concerned with learning. To make that mistake is to make a profound mistake about what is true and what is false. So profound a mistake that Paul has to keep reminding them of things like, you know, just because all of the Jews went along with Moses in the wilderness and they were all part of the same community and everything, it doesn't mean that God was happy with them. Most of them were judged by God and laid low in the wilderness. We would do well to think about that. Just because you're a member of the group doesn't necessarily mean that God is happy with you. You know, it would be a really good idea for you to remember that your salvation is dependent on accepting this message about resurrection that I preached, about the resurrection of Christ. If you hold fast to that message, that's where you're going to find your salvation. Of course, if you don't hold fast to that message, it's not going to be so good. Over and over again, he keeps sort of coming at various issues with them and saying, there's important stuff here, and you guys are getting it wrong. So, when he says that he wants them to be of one mind, he doesn't mean get rid of all of your theology so that you don't have anything to disagree about. He means, I want your theology to be my theology. The one mind that he wants them to be of is to recognize that what Paul has preached is true, and that they would all embrace it, believe it, and be of one mind by rallying around the true gospel. If we were to go and look in Paul's letters, nobody could believe for a second that Paul would say we all ought to just forget about theology. I mean, this is not, whatever else you could say about Paul, he is not a guy that doesn't care about theology. You could never make that case. I mean, his letters are full of it. They're full of theology. Excuse me. You have to be careful. My point here is that by pulling out this verse and just concentrating on the fact that it says, I don't want any divisions among you, we can really get a distorted idea of what Paul has on his mind. Now, I know I've gone very fast over the background here, but a little bit artificially, but what I'm trying to do is give you a picture of, can you see that back behind the things that Paul is saying, clearly there's stuff going on. There are real people and real issues, and he has a particular problem in mind. And I think we can see enough through the evidence that is there to start to put the picture together. Now, what I haven't done for you here, because we don't have time to do it, is to go verse by verse through, say, chapter 1 of 1 Corinthians and show how this understanding works with everything that Paul is saying. We would need to do that. But so I'm not necessarily expecting that I have convinced you that this is the way we ought to understand 1 Corinthians, because there's more that ought to be said. And I should say that's going to be the case for each one of the passages we look at. In this setting, we're not going to be able to say enough to say, okay, here is all of the evidence, here's everything you ought to consider so that you ought to be convinced that this is the way to understand the passage. Really what I'm trying to do is give you an example that all of this boring stuff about who Apollos was and who left whom in what town and when were they doing this, and all of that is a part of the situation out of which Paul is writing. And I want to try to get that picture because it actually can make a real difference. In this case, I would say that when I'm reading 1 Corinthians, I'm not seeing Paul saying, I want you guys to get along. I see Paul concerned with a split. And on one side of that split are people who have embraced the gospel that he has preached, and on the other side of that split are people who are resisting it. And that's very much a part of what is on his mind. And the fact that we need to hold fast to the true gospel is central, I would argue, to what it is Paul has in mind throughout this section. So, does this passage tell me I should abandon theology so that we can all get along? No. What it tells me is that each one of us is called to put aside our worldly, sophisticated view of reality wherever it conflicts with the gospel that Paul has preached and embrace the gospel that Paul preached instead. And thus, when we do that, we will be of one mind because we will be united in believing the truth which Paul proclaimed. Okay, so I want to stop with that and give you a chance to ask questions or make comments. Yes?
I was wondering if you could make a little bit more of a connection. The point that you seem to be making from the passages that you selected out is that the divisions were mainly along the lines of stylistic preferences between the style of Paul's speech and the style of Apollos' speech.
And yet, when you went back to the original verse, he talked about how his concern was for the theological divisions that were happening. So where is the correlation between... I mean, presumably, Apollos was preaching a true gospel as well. So what is the correlation between the stylistic difference of speech and the difference of theology? Where is that coming from?
Right. That's a very good question. The... We can call it a stylistic difference, but as we go and explore what Paul says in this section, what he is defending his gospel against is the charge that it is not wise, that he is not wise, and that by extension his gospel that he proclaims is not wise. Now, the Apollos part of it, I agree. Apollos is not preaching another gospel, I don't think. But Apollos may be, we don't know exactly what Apollos was doing, except we're told that what he was doing was in public debate with the Jews, proving that Jesus was the Christ. Kind of, you know, this is apologetics, sort of. I'm going to go out, some Jew is going to raise the question, you know, well, this can't be so, because what about this passage in the Old Testament? And Apollos, a Jew himself, is going to come back with out of his training in the Old Testament and his understanding about Jesus, and he's going to come back and make mincemeat of their argument related to that. That's not primarily, that doesn't necessarily primarily have to concentrate on theology. That is, all of the Corinthians, I think, the evidence would suggest that they would all agree that Jesus was the Messiah. And what Apollos is doing is out there proving that Jesus is the Messiah from the Old Testament. So a whole variety of people could get behind what Apollos was doing, and yet they could disagree about fundamental things, about what is wise and what is worldly and what is sexuality all about, and is there a resurrection, and so on and so on. I mean, they bring their Greek paganism into their view of spirituality, they bring it into their view of the body and of the resurrection and all of those sorts of things. So I think what's happened is Apollos is kind of a safe neutral. It's not that what he's saying is wrong, but it's generic enough that everyone can agree on it. Whereas what Paul is saying is emphasizing the importance of the cross, and the cross is all about, when you talk about the cross, now we're getting at the heart of Christian theology. Why would Jesus need to die on a cross? What is the problem of sin? Why does there need to be a sin offering at all? What are we being rescued from? What are we being rescued to? And so on. The proclamation of the gospel centered around the cross, if what you're particularly interested in is debate and powerful, eloquent speech, if Paul is talking about very important and deep theological truths that are not particularly exciting, then the style and the theology are wrapped up together. What I would say is, his message to them is, I cannot believe that you would look at what I have proclaimed and say it's not wise. The whole latter section of chapter 1 of 1 Corinthians, he has this thing about how the word of the cross is the true wisdom, and the wisdom of the world is foolishness to God, because through the wisdom of the world it did not come to know God. You know, you Greeks, he says there, the Greeks are looking for wisdom. That's what they value. He says the Jews seek for signs, and the Greeks are looking for wisdom. That's their The Jews want you to show them a sign, and the Greeks are saying, I want it to be sophisticated. I want it to be eloquent and powerful and today. Don't give me any of this kind of old-fashioned stuff. I mean, nobody's going to listen to that and be impressed. And Paul's message is basically, if you can look at the message of the cross and say, that's unimpressive, then you are a fool. You don't understand what's important. You don't understand what's the truth. You don't understand what real wisdom is. Because that kind of wisdom leads you to death, and my wisdom leads you to life. So, I don't know if I'm making my point clear here, but the problem is anyone who would reject someone who is teaching the most fundamental truths about life because it doesn't fit my notion of what is with it, what is wise in their terms, has a profound misunderstanding of life. So much so that Paul, throughout the letters here, is really calling into question whether some of the people that he's writing to really are, in fact, believers at all. So that's the connection. You're right. By itself, style doesn't have to be that sort of issue. Like I say, there could be cliques among us where some of you think, rightly enough, that I'm the most dynamic and interesting teacher here, and then others would think, for some strange reason, that Jack was the most dynamic and interesting teacher here, or David. I mean, obviously those things couldn't be true. You could have that. I mean, that sort of thing happens all the time. And I hope it doesn't happen around here. I really have got to stop kidding like that. People are going to get the idea. I'm going to just stop and mention briefly that the four most significant events in my life are: I became a Christian, I married Robbie, I had my kids, and I took Jack Crabtree's class on biblical interpretation. I'm not sure which order those things happen in. That Jack, I owe Jack a debt that I couldn't begin to repay if I worked my entire life. And so, naturally, the way I pay it off is by make fun of him every time I get up here. But I have a great deal of respect for him and have no problem with him at all. So when I make those jokes, they're just jokes. So what I'm saying is, but there could be those kind of cliques, you know, where it's not good, it's not healthy, but the fact that those cliques are there doesn't necessarily imply that the people who have made those kinds of decisions are not believers. I mean, we all can be foolish and make mistakes about various things. And if, say, someone were to decide that the teachers around here, let's just suppose that all of us are saying things that are equally true and important, but you decide, oh, you know, I just like listening to that other guy better. Well, that's an immaturity on your part. I mean, I think you should get over it and recognize the value of what the other guy is saying, if it's equally true and important. That's something to get over. That's something that we have to learn. But if you're actually saying, I won't listen to that person, and that person is the Apostle Paul, and you're basically saying, he is not wise. His message is contemptible. We don't want to hear about the cross. That's naive, hick stuff. We want something dynamic, something with a punch. Now, you're talking about someone who has looked at the word of life and called it foolish. That's what's happening in Corinth. And that's a very big deal, I would say. Okay, so that's the connection I would make. Yeah?
In verse 4:6, it says, I have figuratively applied to myself and Apollos all this stuff.
Yes.
Why does he say figuratively?
We will have a chance to see that. I would say that when he's saying figuratively, that applies back specifically to what he was saying in chapter 3. And in chapter 3, he has various metaphors that he uses about planting a field and building a building and wood, hay, and stubble and gold and precious jewels and all that stuff. Those are analogies. Those are metaphors. And I think that's what he's talking about. That is a figure of speech that I have applied to Apollos and myself, he's saying.
It just seems like the things that Paul says about these teachings are cruel, like you said, you know, biting and sarcastic, and not things that seem to apply to Apollos, but to some outside source, other teachers that are coming in.
Right.
And saying things that are anti-gospel.
Yes,
and
yes.
And he wouldn't want to put Apollos in juxtaposition against himself like yes. that. Instead, he does it figuratively by saying, some of you are with Apollos and some of you are with me. But he doesn't mean that. He means some of you are with the truth and some of you are with these false teachers.
Okay, no, I understand the word figuratively differently there, but I recognize what you're saying is very right. I think we can follow through. We are going to be looking at that section as one of the things that we look at in this class. And we'll be able to see, I think, this dance that Paul is doing, where he doesn't want to blame Apollos for what's happening here, but Apollos is, in fact, at the center of it. I mean, it is Apollos that people are lining up with. Even though Apollos didn't set out to do that, that's the situation. But I think you're right. He doesn't want to say it's me versus Apollos, because it isn't. And in fact, he's going to make that clear when he goes along to talk. But the issue of me versus Apollos is the issue. It's not Apollos' fault. It's not that he's on one side and I'm on the other. But you guys have created a situation like this, and the distinction between what Apollos has contributed to it and what the rabble-rousers in Corinth have contributed to it, that's a very important distinction, and I think it actually comes out when we look at it. So you're right, that's something real important to pay attention to, because Apollos is not the bad guy here. Roger?
Ron, you said that Christians have lost the ability to read the Bible. And
that was a very broad statement, wasn't it?
It was.
I can't believe I said that.
In context, where do you suppose we went astray? I can see, for example, pastor of church stand up and do 20 minutes to half an hour on 1 Corinthians. Mm-hmm. Chapter 1, verse 10. Mm-hmm. When people do that kind of homily, do you think that lends, that by example teaches people to focus on one verse?
Yes, it does. People in congregations are having it modeled for them from the pulpit a lot of times. Not all the time. I mean, I'm not saying that everybody, you know, I'm the only person who understands what it is the Bible's saying. I'm not saying that at all. But are there pulpits where people are getting up and taking verses out of context and running with them and making all kinds of points with them? Yes, there are. And so we're having it modeled for us. At the same time, though, that poor guy in the pulpit, I'm telling you, he went to a seminary, maybe, and at that seminary, he didn't learn how to read the Bible and find out what the author's saying either, because they didn't teach it to him. And I'm not exactly sure why they didn't teach it to him. Partly it's a cultural thing. Have you ever had the experience? Have you ever gone back and looked at the situation in our country a couple of hundred years ago? Like, read the letters that, like, ordinary farmers write to their wives and that kind of stuff? I mean, you hear the story about how Jonathan Edwards was the pastor of this little congregation in New England. He wrote out his sermons. If you've ever seen the sermons of Jonathan Edwards, they're very, very structured and and monotonous at times. I mean, he can be fiery in his language at times too, but he's very, very rigorous and disciplined, and he writes these long sermons. And he would get up and read them. You know, like long sermons. He would get up and read in front of the congregation. And people would sit there for an hour and a half, 2 hours, listening to him read the sermons. And they tell the stories about how people were fainting in the aisles and weeping for their soul's salvation and all this stuff while he's sitting there reading these sermons. Well, it's because, I mean, I'm not trying to idealize the past, but I do think that it actually has been true in our own history that there is a time when we, in general, as a people, were more literate than we are now. That, in fact, I know that when I went through school, I wasn't taught how to read with understanding at all. I mean, forget about the Bible, just anything. Pick a book. I happen to be a person, I think, who is wired in such a way that I have a real interest in that kind of reading. And when I was growing up, I just taught myself. I read a lot. I read essays. I loved reading essays. I would go to the library and check out big books of essays, you know, when I was in junior high school, and sit and read them. Because I don't know why, because I have a brain tumor or something. I don't know what it is, but it's just what I liked. I love poetry, and I read, and I thought about, you know, I drove my parents crazy. I'd come to them and say, you know, I've been reading this poem, and I figured out what it means. And they'd look at me like, great, that's really good, Ron. You know, that's really good. But that's, so what I'm saying is, I worked and practiced and thought about this kind of stuff a lot for just because it was a personal interest to me. And then when I became a Christian, I had sort of put some skills together that I could start to use when I looked at the Bible. All it took was for somebody like Jack to come along and say, you know, when you read the Bible, you know what you should do? You should read it. You should sit there and like try to make sense of it. Read it in context. Try to understand what the author was saying. And it was like a revelation to me. Oh, yeah, I know how to do that. I mean, I thought it was this mystical thing, you know, that you got these vibes from it or something. But if it's reading, I can do that. I can read. So, the reason I'm saying that is I know in my education, though, I got none of that. In school, there was nothing along those lines. And my classmates, I remember, were lost with that sort of thing. They had no experience, they weren't being asked to do it, and they came away not really being able to do it. One of the things that we struggled with when we started to try to teach people to work with the Bible years ago, you know, like Wes said, it's 20 years at least. I've been doing this kind of thing longer than that. And one of the things we found was that people would come to us, they wanted to know how to read the Bible, but they didn't actually know how to read. I mean, they know how to decipher the words. They could, I mean, you know what I mean, they can read. But to actually sit down and work with a text that's kind of complicated and to find what it is the author's saying, many people have never had the experience of doing that at all. And that's a real handicap when we come to the Bible. Because that's exactly what's required. It's nothing more. The Bible is not any harder than lots of other books that you might read, but it's not any easier either. It's challenging. It's written in another language, in another culture, and I have to learn how to come to it and try to put myself into its situation. So I live in a culture where I don't get taught how to do that kind of reading, and in my church culture, I'm rewarded for jumping to conclusions. I mean, this is my experience as a Christian in all the Bible studies that I went to, you know, growing up, going to a college career Bible study or something. If you start asking questions, if you start saying, gee, what does that verse mean? You know, we've just assumed that it means this. You know, we've already taken it, applied it, run with it, prayed over it, and we're going. And I'm looking to say, yeah, you know, I was wondering if maybe it didn't mean that. You know, maybe it meant something else. And I can tell you, in that setting, you do not get rewarded for asking those questions. You get told that's head knowledge, not heart knowledge. You're just being intellectual, playing head games. You're not being obedient. I mean, literally, there is a spiritual problem with you if you don't immediately get in there and apply that verse. You know, the fact that you could sit there and read that verse and spend a whole evening talking about what it means and not have applied it to anything yet means that you must be some kind of a rebel against God. And I'm not exaggerating. That's, you can find that. I'm not saying that's everywhere, but it's out there. So, put that all together. I haven't really been taught in my educational system to be a deep reader, a reader that's really trying to get at what's in a text. The people who are teaching us have not really been trained to do that kind of stuff either. And in our culture, we are punished if we try to do it. It's not surprising that we don't do a lot of it because it's quite an obstacle to get over. Yeah.
Question, as far as the historical perspective goes, do you know, has, when Paul was preaching to them, do you know, had he been stoned yet? I mean, as far as physical appearance and speech impediments and stuff like that, is it a possibility that he had been disfigured? And
let's see. He has made his way, yeah, I think so, because wasn't it in Thessalonica where he had quite a bit of trouble? Yeah, I think it may have happened to him several times by this time. His first missionary journey, if you look on this map, over here on the right, you see Jerusalem down at the bottom, Antioch up on the right, kind of in the middle. That's the church, that's the place where the Gentile church kind of first came together. Paul was there. His first missionary journey took him out to this island of Cyprus and then up into this lower part of Asia down in here and then back to Antioch. His second missionary journey, he leaves from Antioch and he goes along through, visits those churches again, and makes his way over. He has a vision that takes him over to Macedonia, which brings him up over to the left here, and then down into Greece. He goes to Philippi, he goes to Thessalonica, he goes to Berea. And you'll remember, in Thessalonica, he runs into a great deal of trouble. And I think, isn't it in Thessalonica where he's stoned? Isn't that? Am I remembering that wrong? I know that it's one of those places that he has a great deal of trouble. He goes on to Berea, and in one of my favorite verses in Acts, it says the Bereans were more noble-minded than the Thessalonians because every night they would...